Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 113 with the title Healthcare Without Barriers. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Dr. Helen Weberly. Helen is the founder of Ginger GP, an online health and wellbeing clinic which proudly serves transgender people of all ages across the world. When I asked Helen to describe her superpower, she said it is her ability to drive change, challenge the status quo, and amplify the voices of those who often face discrimination within the healthcare system, whilst also demonstrating resilience. Hello, Helen. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Joe. Thanks so much for having me. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I feel very honoured. I used your services through Ginger GP back in 2016, and I've followed your trials and tribulations over the last couple of years, which no doubt you'll expand on. But yeah, it's a real honour to have you here, and thank you for sharing your time and giving us your voice. So Helen, healthcare without barriers. Tell us more.
Yeah, that's, well, it's kind of like, as we say that, it should be everybody's privilege. It should be everyone's daily bread and butter, you know, healthcare without barriers. That's what we all need. And, you know, everywhere in the news you read about health, you need health positivity, health promotion. It's all about being healthy, being fit, being healthy, being happy, being well. But then actually when some people want to be fit and healthy and happy and well, it doesn't always go to plan. And that's in my career as a doctor, I've seen it several times within several community groups, but none so big as the trans and non-binary. From here on, I will simply just say trans, but for the trans, non-binary, gender diverse, gender incongruent people, I spotted back in 2015 that things were not good and that there were boundaries and there were barriers and there was gatekeeping. And even worse, there was bias and prejudice and harm from within my own profession. And I was just shocked. And it's interesting you say that you used my service back in 2016. I can't believe it's been such a long time since this all started. It sometimes feels like yesterday. And then at other times, it feels like a whole lifetime. Sometimes good, sometimes bad, and which you kind of alluded to in your trials and tribulations. And we've still got a long way to go to cut down and break down those barriers and make healthcare inclusive to all minority groups. And while I have the privilege to be a doctor, to have medical training, to have the experience of the trans community, and while I've still got kind of life and blood in my veins, I really, really hope to make a really big difference to trans healthcare. And I guess, like I say, we've still got quite a long way to go.
Yeah, you talked about bias and prejudice, and I guess also there's, and I speak from my own experience here, there's my own internalization are those biases, prejudices, and the narratives you hear in the media and online and other places. And I know that I, in my early stages of exploring my identity, I didn't know where to turn. And, you know, we talk about 2015, 2016. It's quite a while ago, and the world has moved a long way in trans awareness, and I certainly see a difference. So back then, I went to see my GP, and he had really no idea. There was no knowledge at a GP level. And I think we still find that postcode lottery around primary care support where to go, differences of service or of delivery. How, and I appreciate you're not necessarily speaking for the NHS at all here, but where, what can the NHS learn about supporting trans non-binary people more effectively?
Well, it's interesting. You talk about the internalization, and I think what people don't realize is, well, the healthcare professionals and the public who can speak so foully sometimes, what they don't realize is that people who are about to pick up the phone or go online to make an appointment to see their GP, to take that brave step to say, okay, you may not know this, but I am actually transgender and I would like to do XYZ and I would like you to help me with that. That is a huge step. And the people that I've spoken to, that doesn't come quickly or easily. It may be a spur of the moment second when you're like, I'm going to do this right now. I'm going to do it. I'm going to be brave enough. And that instant gives you the bravery to do it. But it's been planning and plotting for a long time. And I've heard people tell me that they pick the phone up and they put the phone down. They pick the phone up, they get through, and it's like, how can I help? And it's like, okay, can I have my flu vaccine? You know, it's such a brave thing to do. And then when you do it, there's the cancelled appointments, the, okay, I can't do this, I'm going to cancel, and then I'm going to rebook, and then I'm going to cancel. It's such a journey to make that first appointment. That's what I've heard. And then when you get to that appointment, oh my goodness, are you brave enough to say the words, or do you bottle and just say you've got a bad ear, or your knee's hurting again? You know, it's just such a journey, and it's so important that the look on that doctor's face when you say the words for the first time, their response, that look, that are they hiding it? Are they visibly shocked? Are they petrified? Are they disgusted? And these are all experiences and emotions that I've heard, you know, reflected back to me from people who've been through this. And then that internalized, as you say, feeling or shame or emotion that goes back into you as a response to your experience with that doctor does untold harm. Can you imagine going to the doctor? No problem at all. I'm trans and I've just decided in my life that now is the right time to take those steps and do something about it. And I'm going to phone up and I'm going to make an appointment, and I know I'm going to go in and I'm going to have the best experience. And the doctor's going to say to me, oh, that's great. I'm so glad you were brave enough to tell me that. Thank you so much for sharing it with me. Right, let's get on this journey together. How shall we do this? What shall we do? What are the first steps? How can I help? That would be such a different experience. And I have heard that never, which is really, really, really sad. And you talk about the postcode lottery, Joe, and that's just not fair. You should be confident that you're going to get the same experience wherever you go, whichever doctor that you see, whichever nurse, whichever hospital, whichever clinic, whichever outpatient department, whichever GP surgery, whichever flu vaccination clinic. But we again know that that doesn't happen. And even worse than that, we talk online and look in the community and speak at forums, and you're like, oh, I wonder what my GP is going to be like. And you look it up and you're like, oh no, have you seen what they're saying about that surgery? Oh my god, but that's where I'm registered. What am I going to do? So it's just a travesty. And if ever we talk about non-inclusion or barriers or inadequate healthcare, I mean, that's just epitomizes it, really.
I'm smiling and grinning as you're talking there, because I'm probably the first person you're going to meet that had an extremely positive interaction with my GP on first contact. And I'll briefly tell you the story. I was going through some real mental health crisis. So I come out publicly, Facebook and all those sort of things, and then I was going through this real crash. And my wife at the time said, right, I'm going to book you an appointment to go and see your GP. He'll sort you out. I think she expected the GP to give me some tablets, fix me, and tell me I was being silly and getting on with life. But instead, he said, what's the matter? And I said, it came out of my mouth, I'm trans, and I want to transition, sort of thing. It came out of my mouth. And immediately he focused on me. Metaphorically, he cleared his diary. So this 10-minute appointment, I was in there for an hour and a half to 2 hours. He just cleared it. He just carried on. It was seamless. He referred me to the GIC. He asked me a couple of questions around, if I had a magic machine that could change your gender immediately, would you want it to be one way or reversible? And I said, give me the machine, I'll smash it to pieces with a hammer. I never want to go back through it, sort of thing. So I think at that point there, he really engaged, talked about my mental health, and he even gave me his NHS personal email address. So he said, if any, you want to talk to me, email me. You don't need to go through the system. You can just email me anytime if you have any issues about this. And so he's been amazing. And he signed the share care agreement straight away. We got that sorted. So it can happen. But as you say, most of the apprehension is that, well, I think there's this belief within the trans community that medical professionals are all knowledgeable and aware of everything. But I've come to the conclusion and the realization that medical professionals are just human. They focus on their specialism, anything out of their blinkers. They just don't know. And I think trans people are kind of on the periphery of understanding still.
Yeah, but that's but that shouldn't be allowed. And you know, I'm you can't see me, but I'm clapping and applauding and patting your GP on the back here, because that is exactly what we need. But the next step that we need is for your GP not to have to refer you to the GIC. So the next step we need is for doctors to be able to empower themselves to learn about trans healthcare. Now, when I first started doing this, I was like, oh my goodness, do you know what people are asking me to do? They're asking me to switch their hormones. So this person who's got an estrogen profile is asking me to switch off their estrogen and give them testosterone. And that testosterone is going to make their voice deep. It's going to make their skeleton and their muscles bigger. It's going to develop facial hair, make their head hair probably thin, if that's what's in their genes. It's going to reduce their lifespan because men have a shorter lifespan than women. This is all the things that were going through my head. And then I looked at the other way around and I was like, okay, this person is asking me to switch off their natural testosterone and give them estrogen instead. And that's going to make their bodies develop in a way that, an ovarian puberty would happen. It just felt so unnatural to me as a learning doctor. But then I had the fortune of the person opposite me saying, yes, exactly. That is exactly what I want. I want that. Please, as quickly as possible. Can I have it now? Can you do it? Can you do it? And the problem that we have at the moment is, well, no, I don't know how to do it. And I'll refer you to this open hole where I can't guarantee your experience when you get there. And I don't know how long it will be to get there. But it's just that fear of doing something apparently so unnatural. And so when I was wondering about how unnatural it is in my youth, if you like, I looked at the kind of the chemical composition of the hormones. And there's just, if you can picture those kind of hexagons and lines that make up chemical compounds, it was just like one or two bars difference. And then I looked at like cholesterol and they're like, these three, the estrogen, the testosterone, the cholesterol, they're all the same kind of compound. You've just taken a little arm off or added a little hexagon on. And I'm like, they're actually so similar. And the hormones are just natural. They're just natural things that our body needs. And does it really matter which one you have? We know it's really important to have one and to make sure you've got enough hormones. We know that really clearly. And make sure that you don't get them too early and make sure you don't get them too late. We know all of that about hormones. But it doesn't actually matter which one you have, as long as you have it. And if you've got someone saying, well, do you know what? I don't want the testosterone hormone. I want the estrogen hormone. That's going to suit me much better. Why are we not listening to these people and saying, yeah, no problem? And then, you know, again, I'm talking to your GP if he's listening here. It's okay. So how do you do that then? How do we switch off someone's natural hormones? And I'm like, well, we do it. We do that. We do that in kids who've got precocious puberty, is when they start puberty too early, like age 5 or 6. And that's just way too early to start puberty. Their ovary or testicle woke up way too early. And we just stop it. We give them this medicine and that is a natural hormone that stops it. And we do it with people with prostate cancer, for example. We give them that medicine because we know that prostate cancer feeds off hormones, off testosterone usually. And we don't want it to. So we switch off the testosterone. So I'm like, so it's really easy to switch off someone's hormones because we're already doing it in general practice. And then how do you replace someone's hormones? And I was like, we do that already too. We manipulate hormones with oral contraception. We give hormones for menopause, whether that's estrogen or testosterone, when someone's not making enough of their own. Some people are born when their ovaries or their testicles don't work properly and they don't produce enough hormones. So we give them the hormone by medicine. So when you put two and two together, we already switch off people's hormones in general practice very easily every day. And we already replace those hormones with the hormone that they need, the body needs, every day, all day, every day. It's bread and butter. but then if you're trans, it's not quite the same. We don't do that because we don't know how to do it and we're scared of it and it feels too new and we must refer you. But what we've got to do is move towards a place where we're not scared to do it and we already know how to do it. We already know how to do it. Now, the other question actually, which is, well, how much do you give? How much hormone do you give? And it's like, well, we know what the right level is. We do a blood test and we know, for example, that someone with ovaries, we kind of want to see that the estrogen between 300 and 800. So that's what we want to see in a trans woman or a trans feminine person as well. So we know all these things, but yet GPs kind of have this feeling that they don't know how to do it, when actually it's the simplest thing in the world and we're already doing it every day. So it's actually just down to the bravery. It's, should I do it? Am I allowed to do it? What might happen to me or the person that I'm helping, my patient, if I do it? And those are the political society regulatory bits that we need to definitely sort out. And that's the problem. And the other problem at the moment is that GPs are not being supported to make these decisions. And if they ask the question, am I allowed? It's not really saying you are. There's nothing out there saying you help your patient, make sure you do the best by them. And, you know, the Royal College of General Practitioners fairly recently have kind of said, we support doctors. Well, they haven't said that in these words, but this is the interpretation. We support doctors who don't feel able to do this. We recommend that doctors refer to gender specialists, gender identity clinics. We don't think that our GPs should be asked to provide this specialist care. And if you think about specialist care, when you mentioned it a minute or two ago, Jo, that there's been a big rise in awareness of trans people. Kind of, you know, 2015, we had a celebrity or two that came out as trans and there was this big awareness, rising of awareness. The people that have had to be hidden for so long suddenly became visible. And as the braver ones became visible first, the shyer ones became visible after them. And so we've had a big rise. And so what that means is that this is not a small specialist subject. And the NHS have kind of cutoffs. You know, if there's a condition that has less than 500 cases a year, then that's considered to be highly specialised. And that should only be dealt with in super specialist clinics, because you can't have just one doctor in the whole of that area that knows how to do it. So you put those very rare conditions in super specialised clinics where there's lots of support. But we have way more than 500 cases a year, way, way more. And so we have to move away from that super specialised model. And that means we have to bring it back into primary care, which is GP surgeries, and secondary care, which is your local hospital. But at the moment, doctors are kind of scared to do it. They don't know if they're allowed to do it. They don't know what will happen to them if they do it. And they feel that they don't have the skills and knowledge. And if you look at the duties of a doctor, which is which is good medical practice, which is the kind of the medical law, if you like, the first rule is make your patient your first concern. And the second rule is make sure your skills and knowledge are up to date. And so those doctors out there that say, I don't know how to do this, and I accept that I don't know how to do this, and I'm not going to increase my skills or knowledge in this area, acting against the duties of a doctor. And I sometimes feel we all need to get our flag out and march up and down the street and go in front of the doors that are currently closed. And behind those doors, we're having very negative, trans-negative conversations. And we need to knock on the door and say, actually, your duty as a doctor is to increase your skills and knowledge in this area of healthcare and make your patient your first concern, even if they're trans.
Is some of the fear based on, well, fear of litigation, fear of detransitioning, fear of being called up in front of the GMC for getting it wrong? Is it a genuine lack of awareness? Is it bias? You know, trans people have gone from being a bit weird to being a threat somehow in the last 5 or 6 years. We've turned the tables. Now we're taking over the world. We're now a political football, whereas before we were kind of like this dirty little secret that used to somehow leak onto the front page of the tabloids every so often, and that was it. Now, everyone's worried about us. We don't know our own minds. I don't know. I'm really confused as to what the root of it is. Is it just bias and fear of being hauled up themselves? And prescribing off license or whatever the phraseology is there. These medicines and hormones aren't designed for people like me. Therefore, it's risky to without the trials. Is that the situation?
Well, so very interesting, isn't it? So the litigation really means that a trans person is going to come to you as a doctor in 10 years' time and say, you gave me hormones and you made my breasts grow or my voice drop or my, my beard grow. And I now regret it. And it's your fault. You acted negligently. And therefore, I'm going to sue you. So that's litigation. And unfortunately, of course, the media like to show those stories. But what we do know is if we talk about regret rates, with every single medical intervention, there is a regret rate. And when you look at the regret rate for transitioning, the regret rate is tiny. Now, we may talk about why people might regret it in later on in the show if we have time, but let's just accept for now that we know that the regret rate for transitioning is minuscule compared with, for example, knee surgery or breast augmentation or some plastic surgeries, hip surgery, appendectomy, lots and lots of things that we do, people regret. And those regret rates are much higher, but they haven't got that kind of emotion attached to them, and doctors still do them. So that's litigation. We people are scared of being sued in the future in case somebody regrets it. But actually what you need to do is just make sure that person at the time that they're making that decision with you are giving informed consent. And that means, do they know? They're saying to you, please, can you switch my hormones? And they're saying, I know what this means. I know what this will do to me. I'm fully aware of the pros and cons. I know what this can and can't achieve. I know that this is what I want to do. And I really, really believe that at this time, and I've been thinking about it for a long time, this is the right thing to do. And so the doctor's job is to say, okay, well, you know, these are the pros and cons, these are the risks and benefits. What do you reckon? Are you sure you're aware? Absolutely, I'm aware. Fine. And you can't, that's never going to be medical negligence. That is not medical negligence. That is not, that might be someone changing their mind down the road. And we know that's very rare, but it's not medical negligence. It was a good informed consent process. So in many ways, if doctors are worried about that, I don't think we should. Make sure that your consent processes are good and we're fine kind of thing. The GMC guidance, so GMC are the regulator of doctors, and the guidance has changed a lot over my time. I watched it change as I was going through my own process with the GMC. And the GMC actually have become much more trans aware recently, and they're quite positive. They're saying you must help your patient, and you mustn't just say no. You must, if you're going to say no, you have to have a really good reason for saying no. And, you know, they do say if you don't know what you're doing, then talk to a gender specialist, which is a bit tricky because they're not enough around. And actually, if the gender specialists who are working in the NHS at the moment spend all day on the phone to the GPs to give them reassurance, then the waiting list will be even longer. So that's a bit of a problem. But I don't think there will be a doctor in the land who's trying to think about helping their trans patient who won't have heard of my case. And, you know, that's why it was so important that I won that case. And I hope that the lasting message is that doctor went through a lot, but the final message is it was absolutely fine. She managed to prove to the tribunal that those three young patients that were quite stark examples, if you like, it was right and it was fine for her to treat them and the way that she did. And I hope that gives other doctors out there confidence. But we could do with the GMC giving a bit more confidence, and actually maybe even saying, you know, if you deny care, what are the consequences going to be? It's all right, it's all very well for you saying, well, if I give care, will I be, you know, hauled up in front of the GMCs, let's say. But what if I deny care? Will I have action taken against me? You know, am I fit to practice as a doctor if I can't help this transgender patient in front of me? And that's what we need to switch that narrative to. You mentioned the off-label. We use off-label drugs all the time in medicine, every day. And, you know, we explain to people that sometimes the drug that we're recommending for that condition hasn't got a license. And there's loads of reasons why it might not have a license. It's just that some people use that as an excuse. Oh, my goodness. But it's like, okay, if you're going to use that as an excuse, you have to use that as an excuse for all of the things that we prescribe off-label medication to. You can't just say, I'm not going to give it for trans people, but I am going to give it for arthritis or for cancer or for diabetes, etc. You know what I mean? And so therefore, what is it? Is it the fear? Fear of not knowing. If you don't know, if you're not educated, if you haven't had the education and knowledge, it makes you scared for sure. And there isn't enough education and knowledge. If you have a look at medical school curricula, postgraduate training, undergraduate training, later in life graduate training, where do you go and learn how to be a transgender doctor? There just aren't any places. There's no education. And even the very small amount of education that we have, we used to have the Jaya's module with the e-learning module with the RCGP, and they took it down because it was perhaps too affirmative and replaced it with a basic one, which says some people are transgender and you must use the right pronouns and see if you can get the name right. And I'm like, come on, we need the training that says, how do I turn off the hormones and how do I switch the hormones and what hormones should I give and what's the safest way of doing it and how often should I do a blood test? That's the knowledge and education that we need out there and that we haven't got, unfortunately. And then there's bias, you know, and what happens to those doctors who actively won't help? So not the ones that are just, oh, my goodness, I don't know, and I'm not even going to bother finding out how to do it. I'm just going to refer you. What about the ones that say, well, I don't believe in this. I'm not going to refer you. Go away. Don't be such a silly girl. Don't go away, such a silly boy. Look what you're doing to your wife. Look what you're doing to your family. How can you possibly think like this? Everyone's going to laugh at you. And this is what people have experienced in the GP surgery. God is against you. Now, that's just not right. You're just not allowed to do that as a doctor. And it's about time that the doctors who are behaving in that way faced the difficulties that the doctors who want to help are a bit scared of, if you know what I mean.
Is it a generational thing? Does it tend to be more established senior GP, or is it across the board? Is it? I mean, am I being age bias here?
I don't know, actually. I mean, it'd be an interesting survey to do, wouldn't it, of trans people. How old was your doctor? What have you? I mean, we know that the younger generations are much more fluid in and much more understanding. But then also, we know that there are some young people out there who can be very, very bitter and twisted and nasty. And, you know, our younger generations are unfortunately experiencing some difficulties in parenting and what have you, and can be very vicious and antagonistic. So it's tricky, isn't it? Is it an age thing? I don't know. It's interesting. If you listen to people talk about their grandmother, for example, you know, when I told my grandma I was trans, and you listen to the different experiences, some have a great experience, you know, oh my goodness, that's so amazing, well done, pop it kind of thing. And then some are just awful. And so I guess it's across all age groups, the bias and the prejudice. But the simple answer is it's not allowed and it shouldn't be allowed, but it is still being allowed. And that's the problem.
It's funny you say that about age. And I met some Chelsea pensioners in a jazz bar in Chelsea, a Pizza Express in Chelsea, the Pheasantry, I think it's called. And I had a great evening with these Chelsea pensioners. They were just chatting away. I thought they'd be biased and prejudiced, but you suddenly realise that they've had so many lived experiences around the world and lived a full life. And where I thought I was going to struggle, I was celebrated. And another story, my wife's father, my father-in-law, he tells this story about a member of the family you shouldn't speak of. They were cross-dressing or trans or something like this, a dark part of the family. So this is not a modern phenomenon. This is something that's been going on since the beginning of time. Trans people aren't new. It's just, again, we've moved from this, from being hidden to being aware. And I think that's scaring people, isn't it? We're disrupting society.
Yeah. You've talked about that a couple of times, you know, that fear. And, you know, back in the day, were trans people just sexual perverts, or were trans people those kind of people that were just in that house down the street that nobody ever saw and it was full of amazement and wonderment and what have you? Or are trans people in some ways dangerous to people in bathrooms or in hospital wards or in on school trips in the wrong dormitory kind of thing. You know, there's this fear of the unknown. And it's no different from people who used to be scared of coloured people, you know, were they going to be dangerous in some way? Or people who are gay people, you know, were they going to just attack you and have sex with you kind of thing? You know, so that kind of fear and awareness and knowledge and education and actually bringing voices to life, which is what you're doing through your podcast, is how we educate. So as well as the kind of the medical knowledge that we need to hurry up and get out there, which is some of the work that Gender GP is doing, it's also about hearing those voices. And you mentioned voices at the beginning, and you know, the trans voices are being hushed and they're not loud enough, and if they do speak loudly they get attacked with the nastiest and most vicious comments that people are allowed to do, and even to in courts. And people, you know, this debate about trans inclusion or trans awareness or being trans, you know, the debate about whether it's a real thing or whether you're putting it on or what have you, the debate about how we're allowed to treat trans people online or in the street, and the kind of the debate about the things we're allowed to say about or to trans people is being allowed. And it's being allowed in courts, it's being allowed in tribunals, it's being allowed in workplaces, in schools, the debate, I mean. And by allowing the debate, we're allowing that uncertainty, that fear, that bias, that discrimination, that prejudice. If we say, right, actually, on the 14th of March, 2024, that debate is no longer allowed. Trans people exist. Trans people are a portion of our society, and actually they're just as boring or exciting or as ordinary or as unordinary as you or I are. Nothing to see here. Right. Equality and diversity. We respect and embrace diversity. Equality for all. No more debating. The only debating we will now do is how best can society hurry up and be inclusive to trans people everywhere. And that's the debate that we should be allowed to be having, instead of, and it just drives me mad, I can't even read it in the newspapers, you know, the politicians are allowing debate in their own commons or whatever it is, I don't know. That is why we're facing this uphill struggle at the moment. That's because the people in power are still allowed to debate, and they're even allowed to say it publicly. I can't believe it.
Well, they're getting a microphone shoved in their face and asked the question, can a woman have a penis? That's what's happening. And they're running scared because that's a no-win answer, whatever you say. You're going to get berated if you agree, berated if you don't agree. Or if you pause for 3 seconds, why do you have to pause for 3 seconds to think about your answer? So people are being bullied into a response.
But the answer is so clearly yes. There is an answer to that, and the answer is yes. And that's, we've already established this in the Equality Act. And, you know, there are the protected characteristics, and gender reassignment is a protected characteristic. So we've done all that. Can a woman have a penis? Yes. Can a man have a vagina? Yes. Can you possibly be not a man or a woman? Yes. What genitals would a man or someone who is not a man or a woman have? Either. Then we've done it. We've discussed it. It's there. And that's what the politicians should be saying right at the beginning. Right, actually, let's just have some ground rules here. You know, some people that you may think of as a man may have a vagina, and some people who you may think of as a woman may have a penis. Like, so let's just get that out of the way. And now we need to start making some rules and some society and some political policies that makes all of these people included.
I know many women and I know many men. I've never actually really got into the depths of, do they have a penis or do they have a vagina? It's not something that really enters my mind at that point when I'm having a conversation with them. But for some people, it becomes like I have to transfix on these body parts.
Yeah.
And it's becoming kind of, that seems to be the big issue. You know, do you have a penis or not? And is that part of the problem where, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, with all the gatekeeping, if you're a trans woman, you're expected to behave in a certain way. You know, we saw the BBC One documentary. Was it Judith or Julie Grant or something? Whoever it was, the trans woman in the 70s who was on telly. They filmed her going to the gender specialist, and she had to perform and be taken seriously. And I've even heard a doctor even say, "Well, I'm attracted to you, therefore you pass. You must be a woman." That kind of thing, in order. But now trans women can have beards. They can have chest hair. They can have cropped hair. They can they break the boundaries of the social construct agenda. Is that what's causing this confusion, where trans people aren't behaving like women, they aren't behaving like men, they're blurring everything? It's really confusing.
I mean, I think, Joe, what we need to move to the next step, isn't it? And just like, you don't say, look at that black man walking down the road. We would not be allowed to say that. What you say is, look at that man walking down the road. And if, you know, and we've all been there where, you know, you're recounting a story that someone you met in town, and you say they're black, and someone will challenge you and say, well, why did you say they're black? Is it relevant that they're black? And it's like, well, no, I was just kind of, you know, we've all been there. We need to lose that. There's a man in the street I met today. End of. And I think if we lose that trans woman, trans man bit, there, are you a woman or a man, or doesn't matter, do you know what I mean? But I think by holding on to that, sometimes that label, sometimes we're still continuing that divide. Now, I know that there are some trans people who are very, very proud of that trans identity, and they want to be that, in the same way that some black people are very proud of their heritage and they want to keep that. And this is not about stripping that away, but this is about not making it a part of every single label. You are allowed to be a woman, even if you have a penis, even if you underwent some kind of gender reassignment, whatever, whether that was just a name change or a person, you know, the way I want to talk to you, or a medical change or a surgical change, it doesn't matter. It's some kind of gender reassignment. So let people choose whether they keep their trans label or not. But from society's point of view, stop labeling people. I have a problem with people being labelled as homosexual and bisexual and heterosexual as well. Just leave it out. It doesn't matter. They're just people who like having sex because that's a good thing to do if you want to, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, there was a stage in my life in the last 5 or 6 years where that label was important to me. But I don't get up in the morning and go, yay, I'm a woman, yay, I'm a woman. I get up and I make breakfast, I fill my car with petrol, I do some work. My sense of identity of who I am doesn't fit into my brain at all. I just am these days. And I think I always said the ultimate aim of my gender transition was for life to be ordinary and boring again.
Yeah.
And that was the outcome. It wasn't a continual forever party and celebration of anything. It was just, I just am. I've got a wardrobe full of clothes. I've got a cupboard full of shoes. And I've got a coat, and I look at the weather and go, I'm going to wear this today. And that's who I am. And it's, I think, so certainly I agree with you about trying to drop that primary identity of trans or non-binary or being black or being white. If it means something to you, brilliant, celebrate it. But it doesn't have to.
And that's, I think, probably the definition of true inclusivity, when it doesn't matter what you are or who you are. You're just a person in society, same as everybody else. And that's true inclusion, I think.
Yeah, it's your contribution and your value, your personal values, and the impact you have on others that's more important than the packaging, for want of a better way of describing it. So you mentioned earlier about we've been prescribing hormones and tweaking this and tweaking that for a long time. And let me just touch on, if you don't mind, the menopause. You know, my wife is in her late 50s. She's, like many women in her late 50s, is on this cusp of menopause, perimenopause, trying to figure out what's going on. And her GP, and she's had a number of them recently, are really struggling with hormones and the balance and engaging with her. So even from her perspective, there's a lack of understanding around estrogen, testosterone. I've had more blood tests for my hormone profile than she's ever had. They won't give her one. They just said, there's no point giving you a blood test. So they've got no idea whether she's between 3 and 800 or whatever it may be. So does that reinforce the fact there's a lack of understanding about sex-based hormones, if you want to have a better way of describing it?
Definitely, definitely. And, you know, I can't remember when it was, what year it was. I'm rubbish with years, but there was, you know, they did a big study on hormone replacement therapy, and they stopped the study early because they thought there was a harm, and that HRT, hormone replacement therapy, would cause cardiovascular disease, heart disease, strokes, etc. And it caused a major panic. And I think it was one of the worst things that's happened to women and men, actually. Well, estrogen people and testosterone people over the years, because it's really put a damper on the importance of hormones. And in the olden days, we were only supposed to live till about 60. You know, we were done. Do you know what I mean? But these days we live till 100. And the hormones are really important. They're really important for your mental well-being and your cognitive function, which is, you know, your ability to think and work stuff out, if you like. And they're really important for your bones, bone strength. We know that, for example, people with ovaries who've been through the menopause and no longer have their estrogen, we know by the time they're about 70, if they fall over, they break their hip. Or if they fall over, they get a fracture in their wrist because their bones have gone thin. And when you know, if you, sometimes if you think about that little old lady in the street who's humped over, that's because she's got her bones have gone thin in her spine and they've crumped over. We know how important hormones are. And yet we're so bad at doing it. And it's just like, come along now, let's stop being bad at it. Go and read the books. There's plenty of information out there. We don't need Davina McCall to go and to be the one that educates us. Let's go and we need to do this medically and understand that sex hormones are really, really important for very many reasons. And let's start making people's lives better by giving them hormones with informed consent. These are the risks. These are the benefits. This is what will happen if you do take extra hormones. This is what will happen if you don't take extra hormones. What would you like to do? And we have to give that in a balanced way, not listening to the media, not listening to the negative medical press. We have to do a proper evaluation and help people, but we're not doing it well at all.
Do you feel willing and able to comment on the NHS England guidelines that came out yesterday? It's very timely, came out yesterday, around puberty blockers, the CAST report, the closing of Tavistock gender identity services, and what's going to happen now to youth services around gender. Do you have a perspective on any of that?
Well, I mean, people will die as a result of this. The NHS, well, the people who have signed that those recommendations will be responsible for child deaths in the United Kingdom. That is for sure, absolutely sure, which is horrific to think. And what I am amazed at, and again, it comes down to people with prejudice being holding positions in high places and having power to enforce and to make policy. But we've done this, right? We have something called the World Professional Association of Transgender Health. We have the European Professional Association of Transgender Health, and we have one in the US, the Australia. We have lots of PATHS, Professional Association of Transgender Health. Now, they are panels of absolute experts. They are medically qualified, psychologically qualified, and they're lay people. There's big panels. And what the panels have done over the years is analyse all the research, all the evidence, the small trials, the big trials. They've looked at clinics who've been providing this care for many years, and they pull everything together and they make guidelines, international accepted clinical guidelines on how to treat adults and how to treat young people. And they publish them. And the most recent one that the WPATH published was back in 2000, it was last year, wasn't it? And it's very clear. Puberty blockers save lives. Puberty blockers given at the right time will prevent life-changing, life-altering effects on the body, which reduce stigmatization and bullying and harassment and prejudice and bias, all those things that we've talked about. They save lives from suicide, poor mental health, etc. And they give trans young people the opportunity to live their life in the gender that they truly are. Now, I just absolutely cannot understand why people in the NHS who are making these new policies for the care of UK trans people are not reading it. I've never seen it once referred to in the CAST report or what have you, or in NHS England's, you know, they say, oh, we follow the WPATH guidelines. And I'm like, well, clearly you don't, because you're just now saying that these young people shouldn't have this care. And this care has probably been more evaluated than any other care I know because of its highly political and contentious profile. You know, certainly when other treatments that I've seen given to patients definitely haven't undergone this scrutiny. But this treatment has been undergone so much scrutiny, and they've all come together and the Endocrine Society and said, absolutely, puberty blockers and hormones should be given to transgender youth at the time that is right for them, which is when they're ready for them, not when we're ready for them, when they are ready for them. And so if you have a trans young person who is ready for them at the start of puberty and they can give informed consent, they should absolutely have them. And if you've got a trans young person who's ready to undergo puberty that matches their gender identity and they have the capacity to give informed consent, or they have a parent who's able to give informed consent for them, they should absolutely be able to have the hormones that give them the puberty that matches their gender identity. And the rest of the world is listening to WPATH, and the United Kingdom is saying that we don't have enough evidence. I don't really know what they're reading that the rest of the world is not reading. The trouble I just want to say one more thing, sorry. And the trouble is that the UK have been on a pedestal for so long that other countries are following us. And so Sweden, Finland, Denmark, they're like, oh my goodness, if the United Kingdom is stopping it, we must stop it too. And then we use that as a backlog. Oh goodness, well, if Denmark is stopping it, we were right to stop it. And I'm like, no, they just followed us. So it's, I'm appalled at the people who've made those decisions. And as I said, and I'm going to say it again very loudly, deaths will occur as a direct result of the people who have signed those papers.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that, because when I flicked through the reports and documents yesterday, I did notice that the countries you mentioned were backing off. Mm. So what you're saying is almost like it's this chicken and egg. You know, are they backing off, or are we talking about backing off? And they also mentioned that WPATH are almost backtracking on their guidance as well, which I guess, because we're calling into question, everyone's having a conversation now. But one thing I did note significant in one of the documents was they didn't base any of the evidence on lived experience. They completely ignore people's lived experience. It's all about clinical evidence. And we all know that there's not enough clinical trials that are qualitative and quantitative enough, because the sample size is too small often, because people don't want to put themselves forward or don't want to out themselves, whatever. So it's really hard to judge the truth. And that's what my outcome of reading what I read yesterday was, you were trying to hit a deadline of the middle of March for when the current services close on the 31st of March and the new services open on the 1st of April. You want to make sure they've got the guidance you want them to have, not the guidance they're following at the moment. It almost like they were trying to engineer the outcome to support engineer the report to support the outcome they wanted.
Yeah, I mean, you say, I mean, WPATH, when the NHS England published their interim recommendations, WPATH and EPATH put out a statement, a joint statement, and basically said that they find the NHS interim recommendations harmful, dangerous. Those are big words. You know, for another kind of body to criticise the NHS and say that the work you're doing, the thing you're about to publish, is harmful and dangerous. I mean, those are pretty big words. And you talk about the fact that there's not enough research. There's plenty of research. It's just that people don't want to read it. You know, they don't want to listen to it. And they say, oh, the sample size is small. Well, we make medical decisions on smaller sample sizes than that all the time. And also, there are plenty of big studies, plenty big enough studies. What they're saying is that we don't have enough studies where you've got 100 people, young people who say they are trans. You split them into two groups. You give one of them puberty blockers and one you don't give puberty blockers, and you see what happens. And you've got to make it blind so that you don't know what happens. But of course, you do know what happens, because it's quite obvious, because puberty carries on. No, of course you can't do that. Of course you can't do that kind of study, because it's just not ethical. So we'll never have that kind of study. But we do have plenty of evidence to show that puberty blockers and gender-affirming hormones improve physical health, emotional health, psychological health, and social health. We have plenty of evidence. It's just that the people who are making decisions, they don't want to read it.
But how's the world going to change? It seems to me that we're getting further and further down this rabbit hole of political and people making decisions, people with gender critical views making decisions, rewriting the rules. Are we going to be stuck in this place for generations? I mean, is there a way out of this?
It's those people that we've got to make sure that the people in high places are inclusive, and that they understand the Equality Act, and that they understand about gender identity and gender reassignment, and they understand that the debate is not allowed anymore. And those people in high places, those are the ones that we've really, really, really got to make sure that you're not going to be allowed to be in that high place making those decisions if you're not totally and utterly gender aware. It's just so important to eradicate those people in those positions and not allow them to have that platform. And the people that are fueling that in the media and in the well-known celebrities. I'm definitely not going to name them because it just gives them a bigger platform. They shouldn't, you know, we need to start saying that you will be in trouble if you start saying stuff like that. We don't accept that in our society. And within the NHS, within the Royal Colleges, within the universities, and within the politics, we need to make sure that those people are not allowed to have a voice. And if they are in any way non-inclusive, and if they are in any way prejudiced or biased or discriminatory, then they need to be penalised for it. But while they're there with power, we face a big struggle. And the other thing I feel terribly strongly about is that their voices are so loud and their voices are so amplified. And actually, some of them are really nasty because only people who allow that prejudice and bias and discrimination to persist in their lives, they are by virtue got nasty streak in them. And so they have nasty loud voices, which they use. Whereas people who are more equal and diverse and inclusive and better people in society, we don't like to shout quite so loudly. And if we get shouted at, we go into a little shell sometimes and don't allow our voices to be so loud. And that's not helpful. And if our voices are small, we need to get together and shout together to make sure that our voices are loud. And the other thing that happens, as you well know, we talked about it earlier, the person who has to hide in their house because they're trans, that people are having to hide away again because if they come out, they might get stones thrown at them. And therefore they hide away again. And we've got to just say, come on, come out, come and stand next to me. And if they throw stones at us, we will divert them and we will push them away together because I am a trans ally and I will help you. So we need trans allies. We need trans people to be given their voices back again. And we need to be louder than those people who have the position at the moment. And also, do you know what, Joe? If there are deaths and if there are suicides and if there is harm that comes to these people because of policies that people have signed and put their name to, then they need to be held to account for those deaths.
Yeah, I concur. You mentioned one of your superpowers is demonstrating resilience. It's not easy standing up and having an opinion. I mean, even as a cis woman yourself, you must get a lot of abuse, a lot of threats thrown at you. How do you cleanse yourself and self-care?
Mm-hmm. I do have very broad shoulders. And when I know something is right, I will stand up forever until other people will listen with me to believe that it's right. And I totally believe that this is right. I don't have a single shadow of a doubt that transgender identities exist and that we should include transgender identities amongst all of our other gender identities, and that people who are transgender should have the same rights to health and wellness and the most amazing life as anybody else does. And sometimes people want to access medical and surgical care in order to help them to live their best life. I have no doubt at all that all of those things are right, and therefore I will keep shouting. And sometimes people do hurt me, and sometimes, sticks and stones may break my bones. Sometimes, people have threatened me, but I believe so strongly in what I feel is right. And I do feel that I have the privilege to have an education and an eloquent voice. I can counter almost any argument that someone puts to me against what I've just said, because I've learned so much about it. And I want to be able to use that experience, intelligence, eloquence to help a community that might stutter and stumble when I ask something so awkward. So it's really important for me to do that. And I do have a very strong resilience, where many people would chuck their phone or laptop or teddies out of the cot and go, I can't do this anymore. I will take a deep breath and go, I can do this because it's really important. There are a lot of people that I can personally help, and not just by making healthcare accessible, which I've done to thousands of people, but also by being a voice, being an ally, and by sharing the experiences and knowledge that I have.
Keep it off of Twitter.
Well, there you go.
Helen, that's been an amazing conversation. I mean, thank you for my own personal story, but also thank you for sharing your thoughts, your resilience, and your perspectives. And we need to hear more thoughts, perspectives from people who are have the resilience to stand up and be counted, because, as you say, there's a huge bow wave of negativity, which is well-funded, very vocal, has influence, that we hear those all the time. But we know that those aren't the majority voices. They're just amplified disproportionately. And that there is a lot of love and a lot of support out there. And if any trans people listen to this, you have to believe that as well. The world is not terrible. It feels like it sometimes. But many trans people get on with their lives and have a fantastic experience. It doesn't have to be bad. So Helen, how can people get hold of you if this is they want to support you? Obviously, the people who want to troll you know where you are already, but yeah. If people want to support you.
I am on social media. If people want to reach out to me on Twitter or LinkedIn, I'm Dr. Helen Webberly, and I'm always there to listen to friendly people who want to share experiences or who want to ask questions. I'm not there for any negative people. And if you want to say anything negative to me about trans people, believe me, I will not respond. But if you want to learn, to join, to become an ally, to understand, help others understand, if you want to understand yourself, reach out. And I think I want to be part of that human wave of people that have a most enormous voice that gets, because I want to see this in my lifetime. I'm 54 now. I've got, I'm past the 50s. So we've got to do this in my lifetime. So come on, let's get our voices together and start waving those flags and and telling those people in power that we are right.
Well, I'm 60 next year and I want to see this in my lifetime. So I'm with you on that. And anybody who wants to have their voice amplified, get in contact. That's fantastic. Helen, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Joe. Thanks for inviting me.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. If today's discussion struck a chord, consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.